time for sunshine. Take a whole lot of time for love. Take time to praise and thank heaven up above. Take your life as it may come, 'cause boy, it'll be gone soon. Take a little time for howling at the moon.
Welcome to It's About Time, a weekly discussion about overwork, overscheduling, overconsumption, and time poverty. Today we have two guests. First, we'll be joined by Matthew Wolfmeyer, a cultural anthropologist specializing in sleep. Following that, we'll hear from Mary, mother of three, as she reminds herself and us not to let life get too complicated. Stay tuned for those conversations after a short break.
Gotta make music,
gotta make music.
Raise your voice with joy every day. You got a lot to live for, you got a lifetime to stay. Life from day to day, but seems a life's unhappiness here, but leading me astray. Till I saw a friend go down hard and made me sing a different tune. Made me take a little time for howling at the moon. Take a little time for sunshine. Take a whole lot of time for love. Take time to praise and thank heaven up above. Take your life as it may come, 'cause boy, it'll be gone soon. Take a little time.
Our first guest today is Matthew Wolfmeyer. Matthew is joining us to talk about the politics of sleep and sleep medicine. He's a cultural anthropologist who specializes in sleep, and he's currently working on a book about sleep medicine in American culture. Welcome to the show, Matthew Wolfmeyer.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. One of the things I want to start with is something that I read, and I'm not sure if it was in your writing or somewhere else, about this tension that we have between cultural and biological pulls, you might say. So I'd love you to talk about that.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, this is one of the topics that a lot of the social scientists who are looking at sleep these days are kind of getting at, because, you know, for the past 50 years, basically since the development of sleep as a sort of scientific object of interest, it's really been sort of reified as the sort of biological object, that sleep is only a biological need or drive, depending on how you want to look at it, as far as scientists are concerned. And social scientists are saying, you know, wait a minute, let's think about the social aspects of sleep or the cultural aspects of sleep. And so the researcher who's getting the most interest these days is a historian named Roger Ekirch, who published a book called At Day's Close. And in that book, he sort of closes it with an examination of what he thinks of as pre-industrial sleep patterns, and he looks at some diaries, like personal diaries. He looks at crime and traffic statistics in London before widespread electrical lighting, and basically what he shows is that in diaries and sort of literary work, there's this reference to first and second sleep, and nobody really defines what it is. And when he looks at the, you know, crime and traffic statistics, what he sees is that there's sort of a drop off of crime around sunset, and then it spikes in the middle of the night, and then it drops off again for a few hours, and then it starts to pick back up in the morning. And the same thing with traffic and all of this stuff. And so he sort of pieces this all together and figures out that the way that people might actually have been sleeping is that they would go to sleep around sundown, they'd sleep for a few hours, they'd wake up in the middle of the night for a period of activity that might be, you know, an hour to 2 or 3 hours long, and then they would go to sleep again to wake up around dawn. And if you do the math, it sort of makes sense, right? For most populated areas in the northern hemisphere, we end up having these incredibly, you know, long nights, especially through the winter, and we don't sleep, you know, 12 or 14 or 16 hours. And so it makes sense that we wake up, we do stuff that might be sort of local or within the home, and then sort of go back to bed. And we don't stay up all night, especially if we don't have cheap electric light that we can use. And so the in my own work, because Ekirch kind of ignores this, I look at a lot of the medical monographs from the early 19th century, because that's when sleep first starts to get examined by medical doctors. And in at least a few of them, there's the same sort of reference that, you know, there's first and second sleep, and they generally think that first sleep is more restful than second sleep is, and you know, there's all sorts of pathologies related to the division of sleep, but it kind of disappears. And this is Ekirch's point too, that by the turn of the 20th century, there's no more first and second sleep, and there's really, at least in the medical stuff, there's almost no reference to napping either. And so there's this weird sort of consolidation of sleep that occurs over the course of the 19th century. And what Ekirch sort of postulates is that it has everything to do with electric light. That what happens with the introduction of electric light is that people no longer go to sleep out of boredom, you know, like because you don't have light to read or socialize or whatever, you go to bed instead. Instead, what happens is, you know, people stay up until they're exhausted, and then they turn off the lights, and they go to sleep. And so what happens when you're exhausted is that you sleep for 8 hours rather than just sleeping for 4 hours, and it makes perfectly good sense. And what I've sort of pointed to is that that consolidation of time for sleep is really critical for laying down sort of foundation for the industrialization of work and what eventually becomes the 9-to-5 workday and modern school time regimes and the way that we structure family life, like primetime television has this sort of after-dinner slot. And, you know, like our eating behaviors and everything. So I'm not saying that there's some conspiracy around the consolidation of sleep, but rather that, you know, what happens when we start to consolidate sleep is that we start to consolidate tons of other stuff, too, that sleep really becomes this foundation for everything that we do in sort of everyday life these days.
So do you think that we don't get enough sleep, or that the way that naturally it should occur doesn't happen anymore, this division of, you know, two sections or two blocks of sleep times?
Yes to both of them. There's a sort of an activist group, although not quite. They're more of a lobbyist group, I suppose, called the National Sleep Foundation, which is based out of Washington, D.C., and it's primarily a bunch of political consultants, I guess might be the best term for them. And they've allied themselves with some medical doctors who specialize in sleep. And they conduct these polls called the Sleep in America poll, and they do it annually. And what they've shown is that insomnia, restless legs, sleep apnea are pretty widespread phenomena in American society. Unfortunately, and this is the social scientist in me, their numbers are really bad, and their the survey techniques are really bad too. I think it's sort of endemic to a lot of sleep-related research, that what they end up doing is using a really small set of numbers to generate huge claims, right? And so they kind of, you know, thump their chests about how great it is that they've pulled 3,000 people or 5,000 people or 6,000 people. And when you think that there's, you know, 300 million Americans and you're basing your numbers on, you know, 0.0001% of that total, that's really a hard number to use to make grand claims. But set that aside for a minute. Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. And what they're saying is that, you know, 40% of Americans suffer from some form of chronic sleep problem. And that seems about right.
What might be those problems, like what you mentioned, the sleep apnea and...
Right. The three that they identify are sleep apnea, insomnia, and restless legs. Mm-hmm. And the science basically supports that. That, you know, the incident rate of sleep apnea these days is about 20%. Insomnia, depending on how you define what insomnia is, could be anywhere between 20 and 30%. And restless legs is generally about 10%. Other sleep disorders like narcolepsy are about in the 1% area of the human population. And there's a host of other sort of secondary sleep disorders, or not secondary, I mean, they're severe sleep disorders, but their incidence are so small that usually when people suffer from them, their medical doctors are on the ball and sort of get them into the system and get them treated. But it's generally apnea, restless legs, and insomnia that people go for a long time without really seeking medical help for one reason or another.
And what are they saying is the effects of these kind of sleep disorders?
Well, those three definitely entail some sleep deprivation, not only for the person who suffers from the sleep disorder, but also their bed partner, right? Whoever shares a bed with that person is going to, you know, feel the effects of the loud snoring of a sleep apnea patient, or the, you know, constant kicking of a restless legs patient, or, you know, just the sort of side effects of the stress of an insomnia patient. And sleep deprivation has basically been shown to be kind of a gateway to depression, to, you know, anxiety, to health problems generally. It impacts the immune system. And so, you know, it's kind of a linchpin to health in a lot of ways. And when people start to have disrupted sleep, they end up having all of these sort of secondary effects. And I think in the past, largely what's happened is doctors focus on the secondary effects and they sort of forget to ask people about sleep. And so if you see your, you know, primary care physician and you've been suffering from insomnia for a long time and you're complaining of depression, you're going to get treatment for that depression rather than treatment for the insomnia. And the problem could be that sometimes the antidepressants end up causing more insomnia or more restlessness in sleep, and then you just keep showing depression as a primary complaint.
Right.
And what really is the primary complaint still isn't being treated. And back to the question about, you know, like natural patterns of sleep and whether that would fix things, it's kind of hard to say. Unfortunately, Ekircher's hypothesis about, you know, pre-industrial sleep is pretty unpopular among sleep doctors and sleep researchers. And so what's happened is that nobody's doing any research around this idea of biphasic or polyphasic sleep, which would be the technical terms for it. Instead, they're all sort of focusing on consolidated sleep, right? And so we'll probably never really have a good clinical study of, you know, what being a biphasic sleeper does for you. But as to why sleep researchers are sort of antagonistic to the biphasic model, really over the 20th century, they've worked pretty hard to show that we have this sort of set circadian rhythm of about 24 hours a day. It's just over 24 hours a day. And that we're really, we've evolved to be these consolidated sleepers. And the first research project that was done, which people still cite, was done in the late 1930s by Nathaniel Kleitman, who's widely agreed to be the father of contemporary sleep science, and he was at the University of Chicago in the Department of Physiology for years, and really like the lone sleep researcher for at least half of his career. And he and one of his graduate students lived in a cave in northern Kentucky for about a month, and they tried to acclimate themselves to a 28-hour day. And so they sort of had the schedule of when they should be awake and when they should be asleep. And so they would sleep and, you know, for, I think it was 11 hours, and then they would be awake for 17 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So they would try and keep the math. And the thing was that Kleitman was sure that, you know, you had to sleep in a consolidated block, and then you were awake in a consolidated block. And what he showed was that, well, it's pretty conflicted in the end, because the graduate student, for whatever reason, acclimated to the new sleep-wake schedule at the drop of the hat, basically. And Kleitman could never do it. He would wake up too early, he would feel sleepy during the day, he would be cranky, but he wouldn't take naps. And so what he sort of emerged from the cave and said, you know, we've evolved to be these 8 hours a night sleepers, and we're supposed to be awake the other 16 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
He ignored the other 50% of that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
It just sort of dismissed, you know, the graduates.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I mean, this is a research sample of two, which is a terrible number to use. But the problem with the cave is that they've divorced themselves from the rhythm of the environment that we all normally live in. And, you know, even if we have light throughout the day, you know, almost everybody attests to feeling sleepy in the middle of the day. And we've kind of erroneously assumed that that has everything to do with blood sugar and eating lunch, and that we sort of crash after lunch. But the thing is that we crash after lunch because it's about 7 to 8 hours after we've woken up. And if you took a nap at that point, you'd wake up sort of refreshed and you'd be able to do another 8 or 10 hours of activity and then go to sleep. And
are you likening the nap to creating this biphasic, or?
Yeah, I think that, and we can talk about this too, that the sort of siesta cultures around the sort of equatorial band have really retained, or up until recently, really retained that rhythm where, you know, they would sleep in the middle of the day, but then they would also sleep in the middle of the night, and they would have, you know, long periods of activity on either side of those sleeping blocks. And, you know, sometimes nightly sleep would be 6 hours or 8 hours or 4 hours, and the daily sleep would sort of compensate for it. And the problem with consolidated sleepers, I think, is that you have no safety valve, in a sense, that if you're losing sleep every night throughout the week, which a lot of people report to, there's no way to sort of make up for it until the weekend, when people crash for 12 hours at once on, you know, Friday night, wake up in the middle of the day on Saturday, and then they just get back to the grind on Monday morning where they're constantly losing sleep. And so if you were able to look at the patterns of nappers, what they might show is that there's a narrower space between, you know, like their extremes of sleepiness and their extremes of wakefulness, you know, that they're able to sort of be normal most of the time, whereas, you know, exhausted sleepers or exhausted consolidated sleepers end up crashing really hard, and then they wake up, you know, totally revived, and then they crash really hard again. And that might not be the best way for people to sleep.
So in these siesta cultures, do they find that there's a lot less sleep disorders?
Unfortunately, and this has everything to do with the sort of cultural production of sleep science and sleep medicine, it really comes out of the States, in Great Britain, in Germany, and France. And so all of those places are pretty anti-napping, and there's not much research that goes on in any of those places regarding napping.
And people don't go to those cultures and do research?
No, unfortunately. I mean, there's a real bias towards consolidated sleep. And there was that, it's almost 2 years ago now, at the big sleep medicine conference in the States, there was a poster from some Italian researchers who were sort of talking about, you know, the benefits of napping. And when I talked to them, they were like, you know what, we're going to start publishing stuff, and I haven't seen anything from them. And I don't know if that has to do with, you know, them not producing stuff, or them producing stuff in Italian rather than English, or if it's just the bias of the, you know, three journals that publish sleep research in the States just not endorsing that kind of work. So there's, you know, we all like to think that science is really unbiased and objective, but in my experience, you know, sleep scientists are pretty biased towards supporting the kinds of claims that, you know, the science has been based on for the past 50 years.
They don't want to shake things up too much.
Or, right.
Yeah. Now, speaking of naps, I know that this is becoming a thing in the business world where people are, or companies are beginning to acknowledge that napping may help their employees stay
right.
fresh. And I know in New York City, there's now probably several places that you can pay to go take a nap.
Right.
And I read somewhere somebody was saying that sleep is like the new bottled water, that it's like, although it's free, it's being marketed like this upscale amenity. And, you know, so I wonder if you could talk about sleep as this commodity now that we're selling. Is that something that you've looked at?
Yeah, and there's a few ways to talk about it. I mean, I think that there's the pharmaceutical side, and I'll talk about that in a second. But, you know, what you're pointing to are places like Metronaps in the Empire State Building and the Financial District of New York. And there's also two workplace consultancy groups. One's called the Napping Company, and the other one's called Alertness Solutions. And basically what they'll do is, for a modest fee, they'll come to your workplace and they'll, you know, tell your boss and everybody else how great it is for people to nap, you know, when they need to, and then they, you know, will come back to work refreshed and more creative and more productive and blah, blah, blah. And they're really kind of doing it in the service of, you know, they cloak it in this, you know, like, we're going to make your employees feel better and they're going to be healthier and they're going to be more productive. But really what they're telling employers is that, you know, if people take a nap at 2 o'clock and they wake up after 20 minutes, they'll stay at work until 7 or 8 o'clock at night because they're not tired or hungry. You know, like, they'll just keep working until they start to feel tired. And so they're convincing employers to get more out of their employees, especially salaried employees, for the same amount of money, you know, the people will stay at work later. And so there is something sort of nefarious about all of that. But I think, you know, the success, because I visited the people at Metronaps, and I think the success of a company like that has a lot to do with cultural ideas about napping and laziness in the States. And that what everybody at Metronaps told me was that it's not that these people who come into Metronaps don't have a place to sleep at work. You know, they have desks, you know, they have cubicles, whatever. They have somewhere to nap. What they're really afraid of is other employees seeing them nap at work. Or in some cases, you know, they work at places where it's against the rules to nap, you know, and the, so they, you know, they pay $14 for 20 minutes and they go nap at Metronaps and then they go back to work and, you know, everybody just thinks that they went out to lunch or had a meeting or something like that. And it's successful. I mean, what the Metronaps people told me when I was there, which was just about a year ago, is that they're currently in, discussions with people in all 50 states about opening Metronap franchises. And so I think that that's, you know, both an indicator of, you know, the sleepiness of Americans, but also an indicator that, you know, people do want to nap and they're kind of afraid to nap in public.
It's a shameful thing to feel like you need to sleep. As a napper myself, it seems intuitive to me that it makes sense. but I'm wondering, as these consultants or whatever they are that are coming into businesses trying to sell this idea, is there research that they're using to back up their claims?
There is. It's largely kind of old research, but it's, you know, it's relatively sound. And what the research that they draw on shows is that, you know, after a 20-minute nap, people's performance is better than after a cup of coffee or after two cups of coffee. And so, you know, if you give people, instead of giving people a coffee break of 15 minutes, give them a nap break of 20 minutes, and that'll be better for everybody. And there's also, weirdly, this has almost nothing to do with nap research. It's usually coded as performance studies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And lately, there's been a lot of research done by a French sleep researcher on drowsy driving. And it's all about drowsy driving, but one of the things that he does is he has people take a nap or take coffee or caffeine, actually, or placebo to see how people behave and what behave on the road, that is. But what he's found is that almost always napping is better than the caffeine. And he just doesn't spin it as, you know, we should all be napping more. It's more like if you're driving and you feel sleepy, you should pull over to the side of the road and take a nap.
Mm-hmm. Right? He's not generalizing it, you mean, too.
Right.
Yeah.
He could make grander claims than he does.
Mm.
But for whatever reason, there's, you know, no incentive or motivation or whatever.
Right. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Matthew Wolf Meyer, a cultural anthropologist who specializes in sleep. And we're talking about sleep and the politics and economics of it. So let's talk a little about our cultural views of sleep, which napping comes in. You had mentioned this idea of laziness.
Right.
Yeah. So what do you see are the current kind of cultural factors that are affecting us with our sleep patterns?
Well, I think a lot of it just has to do with busyness. This kind of like persistent busyness that people feel like they need to chase after. And, you know, what ends up happening is that the sleep, for whatever reason, is one of those areas that kind of get cut into. You know, we sacrifice sleep so that we can do more stuff with our day. And I think, you know, similarly, people cut into their like dietary needs.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, eat fast food or they eat poorly rather than, you know, really consuming something that's nutritious, blah,
right,
blah, blah,
right?
Right? Or taking the time to eat. And, you know, I think they're both eating and sleeping are these kind of course, linchpins to health, but they're also really easy for people to kind of slight. I wish I knew why, you know, like I wish I knew why the biological need of the human body is something that people are so willing to just kind of throw out the window when, you know, they think they should work late or whatever. I think it has everything to do with success, you know, this need to feel successful. And I mean, I see it in my students when, you know, they're bragging about how little sleep they got,
mm-hmm.
And they're still able to perform okay on tests. And it's, you know, this strange game that people play with their health and with their success, ultimately. Who knows what the long-term negative effects of sleep deprivation are. I mean, I'm sure that they're no worse than the long-term effects of fast food eating all the time. You know, that if you're chronically sleep-deprived, it's going to impact your immune system and your memory and stuff like that. So it might be success in the short term to cut out sleep, but it's probably pretty bad in the long term.
It does seem like some kind of badge of honor that those who say they only need to sleep 4 hours a night and they have so much energy and they get so much done, and you wonder. So I know this is like the question that people must ask you, but how much sleep do we need?
The average, and this can be sort of misleading for a lot of people, the average is about 8 hours a night. And what that really means is that there's a lot of people who are 7 hour a night sleepers, and there's a lot of people who are 9 hour a night sleepers. And there's actually, you know, relatively, you know, 8 hour sleepers are, you know, they're kind of normal, but there's a lot of people that fall on either side of that. And, you know, there's still a lot of people who are sort of 6 hour night sleepers and 10 hour night sleepers. All of that is really within the realm of the norm. But I think the smallest sleep requirement that I've ever seen and that's been documented is about 4 hours a night. And the longest was pretty long. I think it was over 20 hours.
Wow.
And that was someone who is just, like, no matter what was given to her, she was always sleepy. You mm-hmm. know, like, she could fall asleep at the drop of a hat.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there was something sort of pathologically wrong with her that she was seeking treatment for. But even the four-hour night sleeper, you know...
That's really rare.
It is. It mm-hmm. is pretty rare. And, what a lot of people will cite are, famous short sleepers like Thomas Edison, who would harangue his lab assistants for sleeping any more than 4 hours a night. And the thing about Edison was that, yeah, he only slept 4 hours a night, but he would sleep up to 4 hours a day napping. You know, like, he was a chronic napper throughout the day. And he would say that, you know, napping is where he gets his great ideas from. Well, that's fine, Tom, but the fact of the matter is that you're still sleeping 8 hours a day, right? And so there really is this sort of litany of famous nappers like Winston Churchill and a handful of other politicians and inventors and stuff like that that people are sometimes aware of that set the sort of low number for success, right? That all these people sleep 4 hours a night or 6 hours a night, and they were incredibly successful.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have someone like our current president who sleeps like 12 hours a day, and he's, you know, chronically unsuccessful. But and so that's got to tell us something about performance and sleep, you know. And really, it doesn't. You know, they're sort of outliers in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But the other thing about sleep and time is that our sleep needs really change as our body changes, and we don't really take that into account. And so there's been a lot of research around adolescent sleep requirements, and basically what happens when kids hit puberty is that their sleep requirement increases by at least an hour or two, and their cueing for when they start to feel tired starts to shift later in the day. And so when you match that up with really early school start times, you end up having a whole population that's chronically sleep deprived because they can't get to bed before 11 o'clock at night or at midnight, and then they end up having to wake up at 6 or 7 in the morning to go to school.
So do you think that age group, like teenagers, are the most affected by this, sleep deprivation?
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. I was a sleep-deprived teenager, but I think that they really are, and I think that one of the clearest indications of that is that there's all of these soft drink companies who have stepped in to meet that need, right? Like all of these sort of high-octane sodas that, mm-hmm. you know, are out these days. Really are, you know, they're meant to appeal to kids, and, you know, kids wouldn't need caffeine if they were awake.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, similarly to students who talk about how little sleep they get, I hear students talk about, you know, how many Red Bulls they drank last
mm-hmm.
night, and
wow.
It's just kind of, like, incredible.
Yeah, how early we're putting them in that situation.
Right, yeah, and, you know, it has everything to do with these sort of cultural expectations about sleep, and we're making our kids unhealthy, right?
Right.
The other end of it is that when people start to get older, their sleep requirement decreases, and their sleep cue shifts earlier, right? So when you get to be 60 or 70 years old, you start to fall asleep earlier, but then you start to wake up after only, you know, 5 or 6 hours of sleep. And there's constantly in the clinic at Minnesota, the patients that come in who are at or after retirement, and they're complaining of being insomniacs because they wake up in the middle of the night and they just can't go back to sleep. And there's nothing to do for these people because basically their sleep requirements are met, and if you know they were given any medication, it just wouldn't do them any good.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying after 5 or 6 hours, if you fell asleep at 8, after 5 or 6 hours, that's your night of sleeping.
Right.
And just wake up and start your day at whatever.
Right. Uh-huh. 2 or 3 in the morning. So
yeah.
You know, it feels unnatural to people. And I think when I hear people talk about insomnia, what they're really saying is that it seems unnatural to me to be up at this time. But really, you know, they're living kind of in accordance with their biological rhythms rather than their cultural rhythms. And if you can sort of reconcile that, then, you know, you might kind of benefit in the long run.
So people that might wake up in the middle of the night for this hour or two period, maybe that is what biologically their bodies want to do. And so would you recommend to people that they just kind of go with it rather than...
I mean, get out of bed, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, it's kind of interesting that the drug companies pick this up, that it's something like 74% of insomniacs complain of sleep maintenance insomnia or secondary insomnia, which is when you wake up in the middle of the night rather than having a hard time going to sleep.
Right.
And that, I mean, it's kind of a big number. And if you think about it, you know, that's sort of the rhythm that E. Kirch was pointing towards. That, you know, people do wake up in the middle of the night, and if you give them a drug, it might not be good for them. And, you know, one of the things that's come out recently are these Ambien zombie stories and other stories about people who are on prescription sleep aids, and they were suffering from sleep maintenance insomnia in the first place. And what happens is they end up getting up in the middle of the night sort of unconsciously, and, you know, they might develop sleep-related eating disorder, or, you know, they might be sleepwalkers or whatever, but they never complained of that stuff before they were put on the sleep aid. And so there really is this kind of weird space where we might be pharmaceuticalizing something that's entirely, you know, normal from a physiological perspective.
Do you feel like we're medicalizing sleep like we do? It seems like we do with everything.
Yeah, and the numbers kind of prove it. In the 70s, there were just a handful of clinics in the United States, really in the world, that did sleep research and treated sleep disorders. And by the late 80s, there were about 300, and now there's... I think the latest number was 1,800. And, I mean, you know, there wouldn't be clinics if there wasn't money being poured towards it, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of it has to do with pulmonologists who are being trained to diagnose sleep apnea, but they really don't have the qualifications to treat almost anything other than sleep apnea. And so if it's not sleep apnea, it's nothing, as far as most pulmonary care experts are concerned. And so, yeah, I mean, there's this real push, both on the part of sleep doctors, because they want to see an increase in business, and the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, which would like to see more revenue, but also hospitals and clinics who, you know, see that, you know, there are all these people who are suffering of sleep disorders, and, you know, we can treat them. And, you know, it really, over the past couple years, you can't watch TV for more than an hour or two without seeing ads for sleep pharmaceuticals, and they have some of the largest budgets in pharmaceutical history for doing sort of direct-to-consumer advertising. So, yeah, I mean, that I sometimes joke that sleep deprivation has become the new erectile dysfunction, and that, you know, pharmaceutical companies have come to this collective realization that, you know, only half the population has penises, but everybody sleeps. So if there's just a way that we can capitalize on that, then, you know, there's money to be made. And it's true. I mean, really, over the past 5 or 6 years, you can't go anywhere without bumping into sleep-related sorts of stuff. Well, I can't. But,
yeah, yeah.
but that might just be because I'm looking for it.
Right. Well, yeah, a couple of last questions that might be just practical things for those who are listening. One is, I've always wondered, you had talked about this idea of if we're sleep deprived all week and then on the weekends we sleep a lot. Can you actually make up for lost sleep?
Well, as far as what sleep researchers have shown is that you can kind of make up for stuff within like a 3 or 4 day window. So if, you know, you're sleeping an hour less than you need to every day for a week, over the weekend you might be able to make it up. But if you're never given the opportunity to make it up, you're going to suffer from what they refer to as a sleep debt. Crashing on the weekend does have some health benefits, but, you know, it's probably not as healthy as just sleeping as much as you need to throughout the week. Mm.
Now, how do you know how much you need to sleep?
I talk about this with patients all the time, and what I tell people to do, and this is also stuff that I tell people at dinner parties, is that if you have a vacation, what you should do is don't use an alarm clock. You know, wake up when you wake up, go to sleep when you're sleepy, and keep track of it. And then at the end of a week or at the end of 2 weeks, and the more time you're able to do this, the better, total up your numbers and see what you really need. And because really, within a week, you might just be catching up on lost sleep. But once you kind of hit that second week, you're going to start hitting your sort of normal rhythm. And as long as you don't have an alarm clock, and as long as you let yourself take a nap when you're feeling nappy, you'll kind of figure it out.
Mm.
And then to, you know, take those numbers back into your everyday life. You know, if you need a 20-minute nap in the middle of the day, take a 20-minute nap. Find a way to do it. And if you need 8 hours or 9 hours or 10 hours of sleep each night, find a way to do it. And it's tough, and, you know, sometimes it's unrealistic, but I think if you're really suffering from chronic sleep deprivation, you need to kind of figure out exactly what you need.
Right, and like you were saying, I think you might not know it's sleep deprivation, but if it seems like if you're feeling that you can't concentrate or that you always are feeling tired, I mean, there must be some signs that aren't as direct as I'm tired today.
In fact, what sleep researchers have shown is that your sense of feeling tired starts to diminish after you start to become more and more chronically sleep deprived. So rather than feeling tired, you might just feel constantly, you know, sort of aggravated or anxious or whatever. And so it really does kind of blossom into, you know, a different sort of symptom.
Yeah, or maybe physically you don't feel well or you don't feel quite right.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just going to add that, you know, there's been some research and it's kind of argued about quite a bit, actually, that shows that the symptoms of ADD or ADHD really are the symptoms of chronic sleep deprivation. And so that, you know, anywhere between like 25% and 75% of people who have been diagnosed with either of those problems might just be sleep deprived. And if you give people Ritalin rather than letting them sleep, what you're doing is just creating this sort of ongoing spiral of medicalization for something that's not really meeting the underlying problem.
And in that case, could it be that they are sleeping the right amount of hours but just not sleeping deeply enough or well enough?
If you're sleeping as many hours as you need to sleep, you're probably getting exactly the kind of sleep that you need.
Okay.
It's only when you start to sort of cut into that number that you're maybe not getting as much sleep as you should.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing, which I sort of forgot, is that, you know, we have these sort of, the reason why people sleep in 4-hour blocks or 8-hour blocks or, you know, however it sort of adds up is because within that there are, you know, various sleep stages, and they generally break down into about an hour and a half or 2 hour segments where you work through all 5 stages of sleep. And if you wake up in the middle of one of those blocks, you end up feeling worse than if you wake up at the end of it. And so if you figure out how long those blocks are, you can do the math and figure out, you know, whether, you know, you should be sleeping 5.5 hours of a night or 6 hours a night or 6.5 hours of sleep a night.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a, if you sort of resolve all of those blocks, then you're going to feel better, even if sometimes you're getting less sleep. So, you know, you might find that 6 hours of sleep is at the right break in your sleeping blocks, but 7 hours of sleep seems like more sleep. And weirdly, you might actually feel better sleeping only 6 hours a night rather than seven, because you're waking up in the middle of your, you know, stage four sleep.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. Could get complicated.
Right.
The last thing I wanted to ask you about is recommendations for people to help them ease into sleeping and sleep more easily or better or deeper or whatever. I know I used to counsel new mothers on how to help their babies go to sleep. Mm-hmm. And there's all these like ideas of creating ritual and predictability and relaxation. And are those things important, do you think, in order to sleep the way we should be sleeping?
Yeah, in fact, the it's generally referred to as sleep hygiene, and the it hasn't changed since the 1820s. As it appeared in one of the first monographs on sleep, and you know, basically what was said then is said now, and it's that, you know, yeah, creating rituals are really important thing. If you're not sleepy, don't go to bed yet. You know, stay up a little bit longer. Don't take work to bed, but you know, take something to bed that's sort of soothing. So read a novel or have a conversation with whoever you share a bed with, and to use a lot of low light. You know, like one of the worst things that you can do is have a lot of bright lights in your bedroom, because it cues your brain to thinking that, you know, wait a minute, it's the middle of the day right now. And really, you know, it's not. And so if you have a lot of dim lights in your bedroom, it generally helps people sleep. But yeah, like you said, it's really about sort of finding a ritual and also kind of just doing what feels natural on some level.
Mm. Yeah, maybe that's one of the messages, is getting back in touch with what does come naturally to us.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Matthew.
I'm totally happy.
Always really interesting.
Thanks, you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And so I try to keep my eyes open, try to live my life from day to day, but seems a life's unhappiness here, but leading me astray, till I saw a friend.
Sleep deprivation is not unfamiliar to our next guest, Mary, who is a mother of three. She's going to reflect on how to get back to what's most important in life. Stay tuned for that after this short break.
Take a little time for Helen and the moon. Time for love. Take time to praise and thank heaven up above. You gotta make music.
Gotta make music.
Raise your voice, it'll be gone soon. Take a little time for howling at the moon. Take a little time.
Mary is a mother of three children, and she's taking time today to examine the ways that we make life more complicated than it needs to be. She finds that if she can integrate all of the seemingly separate parts of her life, that it helps her simplify and remind her what is most important. Maybe you can relate.
When the oldest of our three children, Bridget, was three and was enrolled in a Montessori preschool in France, she absolutely adored the part of their curriculum that was referred to as practical life. It was a series of exercises drawn from real life that were designed to develop children's fine motor skills and ability to concentrate, while also making them more capable at home. For example, in order to learn to pour accurately and without spillage, students would begin by practicing pouring sand into large receptacles and move on in due time to pouring liquids into smallish containers. The philosophy of Maria Montessori, who founded the schools, was that children learn directly from the world around them. and that less was more in terms of curricular materials. The idea that what she learned at school could be generalized to her life outside was apparently lost on my daughter, however. One day she announced that she wanted to do practical life at home. "Good idea," I said. "Why don't we start by having you pour the water for dinner?" "No," wailed my daughter in dismay. "To do practical life, you can only use a glass pitcher that's this big, and you have to have yellow sand and blue water, and so much for living and learning holistically." My daughter's misunderstanding was funny because she was only three, but I've often reflected since on how often we adults fall into the same mental trap of insisting that things in our lives be done in a very specific way, divorced from other aspects of our lives to which there really might be a natural connection. The effect, oftentimes, is that we end up feeling that the various parts of our lives are not really connected to each other, that they are separate items on a to-do list that we despair of ever getting to the end of. I'm starting to realize, though, that it doesn't have to be that way. Exercise and household chores are a good example. Personally, I'm an extremist by temperament, so I've always loved good, hard, extended exercise, particularly the kind that you can measure in some way. You know, calories burned, miles cycled, steps taken. I've always secretly poo-pooed people who say things like, "You can get fit if you just make a habit of taking the stairs." But I also have three young children, age 5 to 12, including one who has a number of handicapping conditions, and a husband whose work takes him away from home frequently. So a lot of the time, my good intentions about getting what I've always thought the doctors recommended, that is, at least 20 to 30 minutes of continuous and vigorous exercise, at least three times a week, remain just that, good intentions. And the ID for my health club membership snoozes on in my wallet. But now, lo and behold, I find out, courtesy of the Washington Post and the Daily Hampshire Gazette, that short bursts of activity actually yield fitness results comparable to those achieved by a 30-minute regimen several times a week. A study published in Preventive Medicine Online randomly assigned 50 sedentary adults, who averaged about 50 years old, to do mild to moderate exercise at home on their own in one of two ways. Either 30 minutes of continuous activity 3 to 4 days a week, the standard prescription, or just 6 minutes of exercise 5 times a day, 4 to 5 days a week. Overall, the participants exercised for about the same total amount of time. And the results? After 2 months, both groups of participants showed signs of improved fitness, with aerobic capacity increasing about 5% among those exercising in short bursts and about 7% for the others. In short, there was very little difference between the benefits that accrued to the two groups. This is very bad news for people like me, who really would prefer to have an excuse not to do practical, short-burst things like household chores and yard work. I mean, I was happy to find out that red wine and coffee were good for me, but to have it confirmed that washing the windows and vacuuming and weeding are as good a source of exercise as my grandmother would have said they were, that's a bit hard to take. I will be sorry indeed to see my old standby, I couldn't wash the kitchen floor because I had to go to the gym, bite the proverbial dust. And it's going to be a little harder now to justify buying that exercise bike that I've had my eye on for some time. In all seriousness, though, there are some useful reminders here for all of us that not everything that is new is improved, and that what we think of as the old ways may contain wisdom still, that our fitness and our happiness isn't really contingent on our buying something that we don't already have, that extremism in all its forms, including the sort of joint trashing exercise that I am so fond of, doesn't necessarily accomplish more in the end. That a really practical approach to life, maybe, would be to look for, or to create, connections between what we want to do and what we have to do. Now, if only I could convince my kids that household chores are good for them.
Thanks so much to both of my guests, and thank you for listening today. And as always, I'd love to hear your thoughts about the show or any story ideas that you may have. You can email them to itsabouttimeradio@comcast.net. This show has been produced in association with Take Back Your Time, a national initiative challenging overwork, overscheduling, and overconsumption. Find them at timeday.org.
Raise your voice with joy every day. You got a lot to live for. You got a lifetime to stay. my life from day to day, but seems a life's unhappiness here for leading me astray. Till I saw a friend go down hard and made me sing a different tune. Made me take a little time